Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, and today I will be talking to Dr. Emma Hunter about her 2015 book, Political Thought and the Public Sphere in Tanzania, Freedom, Democracy, and Citizenship in the Era of Decolonization, published by Cambridge University Press as part of their African Studies series. The book was winner of the 2016 RHS Gladstone Prize and a finalist for the Bethel Oi Ogod Price. Dr. Hunter is a senior lecturer in African history at the University of Edinburgh and a co-director of the Edinburgh Centre for Global History. Dr. Hunter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I wonder if we could start the interview by hearing a little bit about yourself, you know, how you came to be a historian.
How I came to be a historian. I suppose I came to be a historian, like many people, a little bit by chance. I grew up in Edinburgh, in Scotland. I was very interested in politics and in the changing world around me. And I thought that the best way to understand societies we live in, the political questions that were being debated, was through a historical approach, so decided to study history at university. And I came to African history specifically, really in some ways by chance. So people often ask if I have a family connection to Africa or if this was a long-standing interest. But in fact, I came to African history actually towards the end of my undergraduate degree in history. And I came to African history via a novel, which is a novel called The Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver, which I'd been given as a gift and started to read and discovered that it somehow conjured up in a really incredibly powerful way what it meant to live through the last years of colonialism and to be part of the project of building, of claiming freedom, but then of building a post-colonial future. And having read that book, I changed my subject options for the final year and decided to study African history and have been doing so ever since.
And how did you come to write this book, Political Thought and the Public Sphere in Tanzania? How did this book come to life?
How did it come to life? A long process that took me from that moment of discovering an interest in African history, which was in summer of 2001, to 2015 when it was finally published. So the reason I got so excited about African history at that point was that I was struck by what happened when we went back to the 1950s and could see the possibilities that were open to people at that time. And at that time, insofar as I'd encountered the history of and nationalist movements and the birth of the post-colonial state, it was as a narrative of the rise of nationalist movements followed by the disappointments of the post-colonial state. And everything seemed to be sort of moving towards or tending towards this sense of disappointment, of promise not fulfilled. So I struck by what happened when we go back to the 50s, almost without knowing what happens next, and look at what people were talking about. What did freedom mean for them? What kind of new possibilities did independence offer? In coming to African history, I came to African history and to these particular interests in African history at a time when I was also studying the history of political thought, and I was also interested in and researching the history of nationalism in 19th and 20th century Scotland. And so what I wanted to do was to develop a project, a research project, that would enable me to apply the kinds of approaches that historians of political thought in other parts of the world had developed and apply them to Africa in this period around decolonization, in the period of the 40s to the 60s, so that we could see the kinds of arguments that were going on and that we might miss, or that much of the existing historiography at that time I felt missed, by focusing on the rise of nationalist movements and then the birth of the post-colonial state. And so the origins of the book lie in that intellectual project, but the form that it took again was in large part a process of contingencies and various attempts to find the best way to explore those questions in a way that would be meaningful and interesting.
You're going in the right direction where I wanted to start heading, which is, you know, I mean, oftentimes when we find a book, one of the things that people don't get to see is how much of it there was a plan and how much of it the plan was dictated by either sources or circumstance. So I guess that's where you were headed.
Yeah. So, absolutely. So the first question, of course, was which case study to explore. And Tanzania presented itself as a really interesting case study because Tanzania had a shared language of print in that period, the 40s to the 60s. So originally, I'd thought about doing something comparative, Tanzania and Senegal, and then it narrowed down and became a study of Tanzania. It started as a project, really asking quite open questions and going to Tanzania with those questions in mind. And it started out as a doctoral project in the UK system. That's a 3-year project, so there's not a lot of time to learn Swahili and develop a project that can be done in that time. So I zeroed in on two specific case studies within Tanzania. Initially, Mwanza region around Lake Victoria, and then region around Kilimanjaro in northeastern Tanzania. And so the PhD in the end was a study of focusing on languages of politics in Kilimanjaro. But then for the book, I wanted to go back out again and just think about debate in a wider mainland Tanzania-wide public sphere. And so the period from writing the PhD, which finished in 2007-08, and then writing this book, that was the time when I was able to go back out again and to think about the wider debates going on in Swahili language newspapers and periodicals and texts, as well as to some extent in archival sources in Tanzania more broadly.
Is there just a quick question with regards to this particular aspect of the sources? Historiographically, I can see why focusing on the Swahili press, and particularly like the more regional and local examples of this press, makes enormous amounts of sense, since they haven't been explored to the same degree that other ones. But what are we sort of contrasting them? Was there an English spoken press? Was there like a more central set of newspapers and publications that sort of dominated, that in principle could have led us to believe this is the public sphere, and then you let us to understand that we've missed something behind it?
Yeah. So the question of sort of how I came to newspapers was a slightly roundabout route. So when I was first thinking about the project, some of the models that I had in mind from 20th century South Asian history had focused in on newspapers. And so I initially went looking for independent newspapers that could be a way into this project. And initially, it looked as though this wasn't going to be a very promising way in. So in Tanzania before independence, and mainland Tanzania, which is my focus, there were independent newspapers in the English language. But there were those newspapers were particularly targeted at a settler population in the region. And they had relatively little, I felt, to say about the kinds of things that I was interested in. And Tanzania is unusual in the region in that it didn't see the flourishing of an independent vernacular press in the first half of the 20th century. So in Kenya in the 1920s, we see an incredibly vibrant Kikuyu language press, continues until those newspapers are closed down in the period of the emergency, when public space, political space was heavily constrained by the colonial government in the 1950s, and in Uganda, where there's again a very lively Luganda language press. In Tanzania, that wasn't the case, and people have sort of speculated on why that might be. And one reason is that the Swahili was used as a language of government and education increasingly from the late 19th century onwards, and so the sort of vernacular language publishing that we see elsewhere doesn't develop in quite the same way in Tanzania. There was also a very tight censorship regime, which made publishing very difficult. And so it seemed on the face of it that newspapers were not going to be a productive way forward at all. I actually came to newspapers a bit by chance, in that once I focused in on Kilimanjaro, I discovered there was a really fascinating local district newspaper, which began publication in the early 50s and which continued publishing right up until the mid-1960s, up to 1967. So it crossed the divide of independence. It goes starts before and goes on afterwards. So you can see how ideas are changing in that period. And this is the sort of newspaper which I initially thought would not be a terribly interesting newspaper to study, because it was a district council newspaper. So it was published by the local council. And I think more generally, historians had been quite wary of newspapers which were in the colonial period, which were missionary or government newspapers, given that they were obviously very tightly controlled, and the content was very tightly controlled. And so they were not seen as a space in which we could explore political ideas straightforwardly. And so one of the things that I found myself doing initially was to try to think about how we might use these sources, whether these sources could in fact be more interesting than we originally perhaps thought. And increasingly, like others working in Tanzania, I've come to think of government and missionary periodicals in that period as much more interesting spaces for debate, though a particular kind of debate than initially seemed to me. So that's the sort of newspaper ecology, which is a slightly unusual one for the region. And that obviously makes, you know, shapes the kind of content that we see in those newspapers and what can and cannot be said. But within those within that framework, I think they can tell us quite a lot about the kinds of topics that I was interested in that book.
And it is, can you tell us a little bit more, I mean, not just about the, you know, the sources now, but in general about the debates about, like you said at the beginning of your explanation, there was a narrative of nationalism, you know, which I often have thought about is a very teleological narrative of nationalism, but there was this straight line that headed, you know, led us in this way. And what we have seen in recent years is that people are beginning to say, well, it wasn't quite a straight and it wasn't quite a line. And we're trying to complicate that. There was a diversity of ideas. There was a diversity of projects. And moreover, there's this notion that all these, the political ideas, nationalism, everything, all these political ideas like freedom and progress and these liberal ideas came to Africa from the outside, you know, that they were imported and Africans just like took them and run with them. And it's obviously your project is very much trying to complicate that narrative. How do you came to, well, first of all, you know, understand that there was a problem with it, but you know, and I imagine the sources had a lot to do with that. But I think there's a really interesting project, an interesting problem in intellectual history that I sort of face myself oftentimes, which is how do we argue for the relevance of ideas that were arguably not successful? You know, it's like if this particular project definition was not the one that ended up being successful, why do we, how do we argue for the study of it? Why do we say that it's important? And I think your book is really interesting because I'm not going to jump all the way to the end, but, you know, when you make the argument for how to understand TANU and, you know, and the kinds of solutions that TANU offer, the kind of reasons why, for instance, the ideology of Ujamaa was so powerful, you basically argue that the reason why it was so powerful, it was because it was able to sort of contrast and feed itself from what already existed there, which was not entirely something exported or imported into Africa, but like that had been brewing. So there's all these tensions that not only help us understand the success of a particular project of the nation, but also its limitations, as you rightly say. So I just asked a huge question there for you. I'm going to do the unfair thing and let you unravel that.
Yeah. Okay. So, where you started was why study projects that fail? And I think that is a very important question to ask. And I think for me, the reason for asking it is that those projects that fail very rarely go away entirely. And therefore, they're not only helpful in helping us to understand the active choices that were being made at the time and what was at stake in choosing one path rather than another, but also in helping us to understand the ways in which those alternative ideas continue to resurface and to be articulated in different forms in later periods and, of course, in our own time as well. So I'm quite concrete to think about more concretely. One of the things that I ended up doing in the book was showing that at the same time as new radical ideas about how political society should be organized, which focused on equality, were becoming increasingly powerful, increasingly popular, more conservative ideas about how to make progress, how to reform political society, but to do it in a way which preserved existing hierarchies. Those more conservative ideas were really powerful in the 40s and 50s. And again, they don't go away after independence. And I think that matters, partly to understand then the challenges which new nationalist parties faced after independence, because one of the sort of the problems you referred at the beginning to an older, more teleological narrative of independence in the post-colonial state was that if in the nationalist literature nationalist parties seem to have won complete support and carry all before them at independence, why do they so quickly either find themselves being opposed, perhaps being overthrown in some cases, new nationalist leaders, or being heavily criticised into having to close down political space to stay in power. And if we better understand the alternative ideas that were there in the 50s and which continue to be there in the 60s, but which it's harder for us to see because political space is being closed down and we can't anymore look at if there were independent newspapers in the 50s, they might not exist in the same way in the 1960s. So trying to understand those has implications for helping us to understand what comes next, both in the immediate aftermath, but also then in our own time for thinking about the multiple possibilities. Things were different in the past. They may be different again in the future. And I think that's an important contribution which the history of political thought has to offer. So I think that would be my sort of justification for taking those kinds of ideas seriously. And then you asked other questions as well. So
eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, perhaps we could go back to some of those.
And yeah, we could just break them down. One of the interesting questions that I always find when I'm trying to, again, sort of think my way through, you know, writing intellectual history can turn out to be very dry, you know, because it's not, you know, it's not like this person is doing this or this person is doing that. You're talking about very abstract things. I used to read this philosopher, Larry Loudon, who used to say that when you write the history of ideas, the first thing you have to ask yourself is, what were these ideas in response for? So like a very instrumentalist view. In other words, ideas are trying to solve a problem. Let us see how they solve that problem. And I saw a little bit of that in your book. I mean, there was a point where you asked the question, you were talking about the political parties, specifically about things, citizens unions and political parties like KANU, and they say they provided different sorts of answers to the same questions about social change and political authority and where it should lie. And I think what is interesting about, especially about the chronology of your book, is that not only that it explores that moment of nationalism and mass nationalism, but it actually brings the chronology way back to the moment where independence is not even imminent, you know, where people, you know, we wouldn't typically have brought that that chronology so far back, especially not in terms of having people just imagine community or imagine, you know, political power or imagine these things. And by showing that that these were concerns that existed and that had people had been reflecting and giving answers to these questions way before this sort of project of nation had existed, it sort of allows us to have a history, you know, to have a story that we can sort of flesh out. So I guess my question is, you know, how do you think about that? How do you tell a story around ideas? You know, the structure of your book is a good example of how to do that. So I was just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how you thought about the structure of your books. You know, you have chapters where you concentrate on concepts and then chapters where you look at how those concepts sort of play out.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And yes, absolutely. So one of the things that I thought it was important to do was to separate out nationalism from a much longer and deeper history of political argument. So political thinking doesn't start in 1945, of course. And I think the structure of the book, in a sense, I was going to say it kind of constructed itself, but it also was a very, very long process. I started working on it comes out of a PhD thesis, which was finished in 2007-08, and I really started working on the book in about 2009 and finished it in 2014, and there were many structures on the way to it becoming this structure. But in saying that it wrote itself, I think that, you know, the first chapter, which probably took the longest to research and write, was very important for me because I wanted to set up the intellectual context in which the political arguments of the 50s and 60s were taking place. I needed to do that, I think, in order to make sense for myself partly, but also then ultimately for readers of what these political arguments were about. So while chapters 4 and 6, in fact, come out of the PhD thesis, chapter 1 I researched and wrote later, of going back and saying, well, what was this intellectual context in which they were operating? It's based, the first chapter is where I explore the ways in which people are debating or thinking about what progress means. And I was struck reading across a really wide kind of corpus of printed texts from the 40s and 50s, but also building on work that I'd previously done, looking at earlier discussions particularly from the 20s onwards, of how central arguments around progress were, but also that when people were talking about progress, they were talking both about the positives of what progress could mean, but also about the dark side, about the sense that things could very easily fall apart, the sense that there were risks, that there were dangers at stake in progress, whatever that might be. So drawing that out provides really the foundation for everything that comes next, because then we can see how these sort of core questions shape many of the arguments that take place later. To put that in a wider sort of historiographical context, when people at the time looked at these sort of arguments, they said, well, it's about a clash between tradition and modernity. And really what I found in what I was reading was that it was never as clear cut as that, that it sometimes seemed to political actors at the time that a person could be simply put in a box as either somebody who wanted modernity, was in favour of progress, and somebody who was looking to the past. Whereas actually it seemed to me that everybody was in the same space of thinking, well, how do we make life better? What does progress look like? But also, what are the risks involved? And what are some of the ways in which perhaps some of the older social structures or social bonds might, in fact, be helpful in building that future? But also, what are the risks involved what are the potential risks of society breaking apart as social and political and economic change happens? So in terms of the structure of the book as a whole, I think that point about how to make the history of ideas readable and work as a book, and partly for me the answer to that was to try to show not only that these ideas mattered in and of themselves, but also that they did have a political import, that we can better understand the politics of the period as well by understanding the intellectual history of the period. And so rather than see those as two separate things, I wanted to integrate the two together. And so the book is... The first three chapters of the book are broadly in the approach is one of history of ideas, starting by setting up the intellectual context of arguments over progress and its discontents, really. Then thinking about the way that languages of democracy were being introduced, but also changing in a transnational public sphere, but also within Tanzania in the period immediately after the Second World War. And then in the third chapter, trying to understand the way in which concepts of representation had developed and gained traction over the first half of the 20th century, as you say, significantly before the era of mass nationalism. But it's crucial to understand those new concepts of representation in order to understand what happens in the period of mass nationalism. But then chapter four tries to say, okay, well, what does this actually mean in practice? What does this mean in the case of an actual political movement? To give the reader that concrete sense of sort of ideas in practice, ideas in action. And then similarly, chapter five moves on to a more more of an intellectual history of thinking about ideas of freedom as they travel. But in chapter six, again, we pin it down in a very concrete case study. And then chapter 7a, as you said in an earlier question, I'm trying to answer some really good perennial questions that historians of Tanzania have been asking for a long time, but also historians of the histories of African socialism, of histories of one-party states in Africa, but saying, well, having seen this intellectual history, now we can better understand how this played out in this case study of Tanzania. So that's why it took the form it did. And I hope it therefore managed to be a readable story that readers could hopefully find interesting and see the arc of the argument as it develops over the 200 or so pages.
Well, it is very readable, so definitely.
Good.
It is a very good model. The other thing that I thought it was very interesting in the text, and when you compare it again with other sort of narratives of sort of the development of politics and political thought in particular during the nationalist period, is that there's a number of tensions here, which are very well explained. And I'm going to ask you to first to explain a little bit, how do you negotiate it? Why do you feel, for instance, that it was important to talk about not just about the local context in which these concepts developed, but also the transnational elements that sort of fed into that development and were fed in turn by those developments. So that would be the first question. But then the second question is what is not, we don't find in your book, which I think is really interesting, and I would like you to explain how you managed to pull this one, is there's no debates about, well, this is what the colonized people were doing, and this is how the colonial people were responding. You know, and I think part of that has to do, as you explain in the book, with the very particular history of colonialism in Tanzania. You know, there's no that distinction. It makes no sense in many other parts of Africa, but it makes even less sense in the Tanzanian context. But there's also like a way of sidestepping that sort of that debate, you know. And I wonder if you could explain to us how you managed to do that.
Yeah. Oh, both really, really good and big questions. Okay, why the local and the international? Because you can't understand it without both is the short answer, I think. As you indicated, there are sort of oddities of the Tanzanian case that make the international particularly important. And that's the fact that after the First World War, Tanganyika became a League of Nations mandate. And then after the Second World War, a United Nations trusteeship territory. And so in the period that I'm looking at in the book, which mainly is not entirely, but mainly is focusing on the period after 1945, mainland Tanzania's future is being discussed at the United Nations. And so global arguments, transnational arguments about what kind of political system should develop in Tanzania are helping to shape what in fact happens on the ground. And Tanzanians are engaging with those arguments to some extent. Nyerere speaks at the UN, other political actors speak at the UN as well. But these are also tied up with other ideas. In one of the chapters, I talk about a clash in the trusteeship council between Soviet representative and the British representative of very different ideas about what democracy means, understandably. But I also was struck and I think it's really important to see both the ways in which debates in Tanzania echo debates in other parts of the world. And I think sometimes in African studies, we focus on Africa to the exclusion of other parallel cases elsewhere in the world. And this book was shaped not just by my own work in African history, but also by the fact that I was teaching at the time I was writing the book. I was teaching very broad imperial and global history courses, and so reading about the same period and politics in Southeast Asia, in the Middle East, in South Asia, and one can't help but be struck by the ways in which similar arguments are playing out and similar ideas are being employed. But equally, as you said at the beginning, we can't understand, as I see it, the political thought of Tanzania purely as the imposition of external ideas. Ideas are forged in dialogue and in ways which draw on older ideas from within Tanzania, as well as from wider debates which are taking place, which Tanzanians are a part of. So I think that's why was one of the things that I wanted to bring out very clearly was the dialogue between the local and the global. An original title of this book was Languages of Freedom, Making Tanzanian Political Society in an International Age. And I think that captures something about it, that it was forged in that context and in that dialogue. And then the second question you raise again is a very important one. Tanzania is, as you say, is a slightly unusual case. And the one of the things which struck me and which I thought it was important to bring out was that debates taking place in the Swahili language were debates in which colonial officials could and did contribute as much as African writers and authors. And I think that it's important to recognize that and to think about what that means. So as I said right at the beginning, my initial thought when I went to Tanzania and found that there wasn't an independent African press, I thought, well, that means I can't do anything with this, that actually I don't have the sources in terms of newspapers and protocols to do what I want to do. But actually, of course, that speaks to the way in which discussions were not in the wider Swahili phone public sphere. Discussions did involve both colonizers and colonized. And I think we need to think about that and to recognize that. Rather than think of Swahili language newspapers as a sort of autonomous space of African thought, political thinking was entangled. It was shaped by the power dynamics of the colonial relationship, and we need to try to understand that. But I think there's the choice I made in that book was to approach it in that way. I think the challenge, though, is how do we do that in a way that makes clear the realities of those power dynamics? As I've said already, this space was a tightly controlled space. It was a censored space. So what we are seeing here is shaped by that context. And what we certainly, what I hope we can do is to show that this was a highly unequal, segmented society, even as political ideas were worked through in what was linguistically and structurally a shared space. So, yeah, that's I think is a real challenge. I was reading through the book again today, and I found myself wondering whether more needed to be said about the colonial context broadly, and what that meant. And perhaps if I was to revisit the book now, I would try to bring that out a bit more clearly. But at the same time, I think approaching it in that way helps us better understand the what kind of space this was, essentially.
Yeah, no, and I think one of the more rich parts of the book is that it allows us to think of that space, as you call it, as a much more complicated space than this sort of bifurcated, like you mentioned. I mean, I don't think at any point there is a sense that, if the problem of African historians, or if like the guiding principle of Africanism, Africanists' historiography, has always been this issue of agency. I mean, I don't think that is sort of trivialized at all. On the contrary, you know, it's sort of expressed, particularly going back to sort of the initial question, the fact that there is an inequality inherent in the space in which these ideas are being debated in no way minimizes the relevance of said ideas at the time for the people who were debating them. And I think that comes about really well in the text.
Absolutely. And these ideas, of course, continue to shape the political structures that are in place today. And one of the challenges is to understand how they were grounded in that period. Again, it sort of goes back to that point that you made right at the beginning, that if we can't see it simply as something imposed from outside, we have to see it as something which is forged in a particular context.
One last question, and I think this goes back a little bit to this last point that you're making. I think ultimately what one of the central questions that these individuals were asking themselves is, how do we live together? So I think even before the question of how do we get rid of colonialism is the question of, you know, how do we live together? How do we think of ourselves as a community? And I think to the extent that we can record those debates and those ideas, like you said, they have a much better chance of coming back and of people looking back at their own intellectual histories and said, hey, we've thought about this for a longer time and here's some ideas that we used to have. Do you see that in present or in the sort of like the kind of intellectual discourse that has followed, you know, independence?
Yeah, as you say, the question, how do we live together, which is something which you know, all societies ask at all times. Tanzania's history since independence, in many ways, we still are living with the legacies of some of what happened in that period. Tanzania's still, the ruling party in Tanzania is CCM, which was the successor of the Nationalist Party, TANU. That's the focus in parts of my book. And so the arguments that were put forward around why have one-party democracy remained powerful up till until the 1980s, and we see iterations of them, or similar sort of arguments indeed going on today, even in the era of multi-partyism. And this the questions around what does progress look like, and what do we and what are the risks to society? Again, of course, these are questions that all societies continue to ask. I think I think as in Tanzania at the moment is as it has been for a long time, debating what the future might hold, and we see people have written about the way in which Nyerere's ideas, and particularly the kind of the moral content of Nyerere's ideas, have remained incredibly powerful. And it's interesting that this has been a resource which both the ruling party, CCM, and other parties within Tanzania have drawn on, that Nyerere has sort of ceased to be the property of any one party. And I think one of the things, although Nyerere doesn't feature as heavily in my book as he has done in some accounts of the period, so Julius Nyerere, who was the leader of TANU and the first president of Tanzania, nevertheless, what I try to do in the book is to put him in the context of the wider debates that were going on, and suggest some of the ways in which he provided a compelling answer to the challenges people faced. So in the way that his name is recalled and his ideas continue to be discussed in public debate in Tanzania, I think we see some of the legacies of this period, perhaps.
Well, wonderful. Thank you for that book. It was a really pleasure to read it. And so, Dr. Hunter, I think we've taken a lot of your time. Could you tell us what you're working on right now?
Yeah, sure. One of the places where the book ends is with reminder that the voices that we hear in this book are those of people who are literate, who are writing in newspapers and periodicals, as well as in other textual forms, and who are engaging with global ideas, who are engaging with the world, but they often themselves are not traveling. And I was been struck by the ways in which when historians have approached global history from East Africa, they've often focused on mobile people, people who are moving. But through a focus on text, we can get at others who are engaging with the world through print, but who are not themselves physically moving. So one of the projects that I'm working on at the moment is in some ways engaging with the themes of this book, and adopting similar approaches to what I've done before, but taking a slightly different direction. So it's a collaborative project with Dan Branch, who's a historian of Kenya, University of Warwick, Jess McCann, who's a historian of Indian-African relations at the University of York, Ismay Milford, who's just finished a PhD in African and global intellectual history at the EUI in Florence, and Daniel Heathcote and Anna Adima, who are doctoral students on the project. And the project's called Another World, East Africa and the Global 1960s. And what we're trying to do is to understand why it was that the cosmopolitan connections of the 40s and 50s are to some extent break down and across the region are replaced with an introverted nationalism in the later 60s and into the 70s. And so we're trying to think about globalization from East Africa and the ways in which globalization can go backwards as well as forwards, can break apart. And we're doing it in a similar way to the way that I've done it in this book, through a focus on texts and print and textual cultures and a focus on ideas rather than politics and economics. So it's a four-year project. We just started in September, but it's very exciting. And it's really exciting to be working as part of a team with everyone bringing slightly different expertise, different forms of expertise and different skills to the project. So I hope that will go in some interesting directions and be able to help us rethink global history from East Africa in the years ahead.
Well, that sounds like a great project and a very relevant one if we are to think about those like ebbs and flows of globalization.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the podcast today. I really enjoyed it. I hope you did so too. So take care and thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.